will connect to theoretical physics. So this is not going to be a big, broad overview talk touching on all aspects of LHC physics. I'm going to just focus on a few parts that I've been involved in particular. But before giving an outline about what I'll talk about, let me just give a brief introduction to the LHC. So the LHC, or the Large Hadron Collider, is at this point, combined with the experiments situated around it, is certainly the largest experimental effort in human history. It's a collider 27 kilometers in diameter. When it's fully operational, it'll collide protons on other protons at 14 TeV, which is roughly a factor of 7 higher than what currently exists at Fermilab, although for the next several years, probably this energy range will be a bit lower. So for the first time ever, we'll be probing length scales of unprecedented size at a particularly interesting range, 10 to the minus 18 centimeters, well below the length scale associated with weak interactions. Now, why do we care about what this machine and its experiments has to say? So there are several questions that can be addressed with the LHC, but there's two broad categories that I think stand out. One is the origin of the weak scale. The other is the origin of dark matter. Now, I think this story is probably familiar to many of you already in this room, so let me just provide a summary. So it's already known just within the standard model that without any additional structure, the weak interactions become strong at the TeV scale. So it's usually assumed that we'll either discover new dynamics or new particle states of some kind that will tell us about how the standard model is completed into a theory that makes sense to higher energies. Okay? Now, the Higgs particle is probably the most compelling candidate for an explanation for the origin of the weak scale, in the sense it is the object that gives mass to the W and the Z bosons, the mediators of the weak force. But there's an immediate puzzle concerning the Higgs sector, namely that quantum corrections that should give that are sensitive to the Planck scale should bring the weak scale all the way up to the Planck scale. So it's a little bit of a mystery that weak interactions broken by some Higgs particle at a very large distance compared to quantum gravity should not be destabilized by quantum corrections and pushed to a high scale. Okay, so that's one thing that we're going to want to search for and understand. Of course, perhaps the weak scale is fine-tuned. This is an interesting possibility that's been discussed quite a bit over the last couple of years. And that's something else that we would want to look for evidence of, if that's indeed the case. The other category is the origin of dark matter. And a very good candidate for dark matter is that it's a TeV scale stable particle of some kind. And one of the goals of the LHC is to see if we can produce dark matter directly and then study its properties. Probably one higher level than that is just to see if dark matter has anything at all to do with the origin of the weak scale and the dynamics that explains this big hierarchy between the Planck scale and the weak scale. Okay? Now, these are the questions that have been around for, I would say, 20 years now, 10 to 20 years. Everybody in particle theory knows about these. This certainly drives model building. It drives a lot of how we think about physics at the TeV scale. But to date, there's no real compelling evidence that any one particular theory is better than another. So I think it's fair to say that the unexpected is likely at the LHC. And in that case, it's quite possible that the interesting theoretical questions aren't even known yet. And part of the excitement of the next several years will be identifying what those are. Now, the LHC is already taking data. Both CMS and ATLAS, the two multipurpose detectors at the LHC, have already accumulated some data at close to 2.4 TeV. And the energy is rising. The luminosity will increase this year. In practice, what happens when you collide protons, what you look for are events that look something like this, where you see there's an interaction point in the center of these huge detectors, and you see sprays of particles that come out relatively central in the detector. So the protons go in the forward direction, and you see these sprays of particles coming out. And you can reconstruct individual tracks of particles in tracker detectors inside in the interior, and then you look at energy deposits on the outside. And from that, you can try to reconstruct what the underlying physics reaction was. Okay. So in this particular example, there's two jets. So jets are objects that occur when you have things like gluons
produced in the initial state, which then radiate and produce pions and kaons and other strongly interacting particles, and they come in these objects called jets. And you see that in this event. You see this spray of particles. It leaves energy in these calorimeters out here that are designed to detect energy. And so you can map out the shape of that energy deposition, and you can see that these are objects that look like QCD events. So CMS also is taking data, and they also see events, not unlike what I just showed. In some cases, instead of seeing strongly interacting states, you see evidence for just leptons, things like muons, at high momentum. And those are particles that pass through the inner trackers, they pass through the detectors that are meant to pick up energy deposition. They actually pass quite a ways through the detector, and you can see them bending. It doesn't show up too well in this plot, but you can see them bending in the magnetic field, and you reconstruct them as muons. And that, in turn, tells you something about some hard scattering process. Now, this is really the challenge, though, as far as theory is concerned. How does this kind of information tell us about long-standing questions in theoretical physics, right? How does this tell us what the underlying principles of nature are at the TEV scale? How does this tell us if there's supersymmetry or if the electroweak scale is natural? How do we know if something surprising is happening? Okay. Now, that's what I want to talk about. This is a fairly involved process, suffice it to say. There's not a lot of history to go on in this instance, because past discoveries at Hadron Collider machines, such as the discovery of the W and the Z, the discovery of the top, were largely discoveries that occurred in an environment where we already knew what the masses and the couplings of the particles were ahead of time. In the case of the W and the Z, we knew both the mass and the couplings. We knew exactly where to look for them. In the case of the top, there was one unknown parameter. And certainly, this was still a difficult discovery. These popped out relatively easy, but the point is we knew what to look for. We're not in that situation now. We have ideas for what we should look for. But what makes this machine so exciting is that it's really an exploration into territory where our theory guidance doesn't appear to be working too well. Okay? So the level of uncertainty is tremendously high. Now, in practice, as theorists, the first point of contact with LHC data might look something like this. Okay? And this is at least a few years from now. Okay? So there is a tremendous amount of effort involved in rediscovering the standard model first with these experiments. They first have to go through that process of understanding the standard model and then searching for new physics and trying to separate off the standard model component. And eventually one hopes to see distributions like this, where there's some kinematic variable here on the x-axis, there's a standard model prediction, and then there's data. There's some deviation. We don't know what it is. And of course, immediately we can go to work constructing models to try to understand how the models might match these distributions. And this is where I want to just pose the question, how do we do this in a way that makes any sense at all? How do we characterize models at the LHC? How do you characterize models at the LHC that can be used to describe data and inform theoretical investigation? Okay. Now, this may seem like a question that won't be of relevance for another few years. But in fact, that's not the case, because the way you choose to do this informs the way you search for models. And so I'll get to that a little later in the talk. Okay. So I'm going to first talk about spectroscopy, because spectroscopy, and I'll tell you what I mean by that, spectroscopy at the LHC is that is essentially the content that we can expect to receive from that machine over the course of several years. That is also the information that directly connects to theory. I'm going to talk about how spectroscopy can be encapsulated with a particular kind of theoretical framework that we called on-shell effective theories that are closely related to effective theories in the technical sense. And then I'll talk about how this theoretical description, these OSETs, are used. And most of the uses to date, I believe, are occurring in CMS. And I'll talk about some of those. Okay. So spectroscopy. I think almost all of us know what it means in some sense. What we can hope to obtain from the LHC are a set of pictures like this that can be associated with the kinds of kinematic distributions that I just showed you. Pictures that show us how heavy new particles are produced, how they decay, what kinds of intermediate particles appear in the decay, an estimate of their mass, and how often these different decays occur. Okay, just and why do you want this information? Well, first of all, the way that this diagram appears, the topology of the diagram, it tells you something about the gauge and global quantum numbers of new physics, which in turn is an important input into constructing a theory at the weak scale. Why do you want to know masses? Well, masses are particularly useful for discriminating among different theoretical options, and certainly, so they're powerful discriminators of high-scale theories. And rates, so the relative rates of different decay topologies, this gives you information also about gauge and global quantum numbers, and it is the best probe that we have of the underlying couplings of a given theory. Okay, so at the level of data, topologies, masses, and rates encapsulate all the information that as theorists you want to construct either a supersymmetric model or a theory of extra dimensions or something that we haven't yet thought of. That essentially encapsulates all of the nitty-gritty collider information in a way that's useful for theoretical investigation. Now, precisely what this will mean, what we'd like to see then in characterizations of data are pictures like these, where we have some picture where we have an estimated mass scale, or maybe two or three mass scales, with some estimate for how often particular particles with particular quantum numbers are produced. So here I'm going to show a sequence of production processes. We want to know sort of what the hierarchy of production rates are. We want to know that, for example, in this case, the strongest production rate occurs for a particle with quantum numbers like a quark, followed by particles with quantum numbers like a gluon. Okay? And then on top of that, you want to have diagrams associated with how these particles are decaying, and you want to know how often the decays occur, just quantitatively. All right? Now, I can draw these pictures, and we can certainly conceptualize this precisely. But actually, it's far from obvious that simple pictures like this are even remotely enough to describe data in practice, okay? Or that this information is enough to give an accurate description of data. And that's what you need before you can answer any quantitative questions about masses or decay rates or anything like that. So the fact that spectroscopy is what you get out of the LHC, that's actually not entirely obvious. So I'll talk about that in just a bit. What I do want to convince you of, though, is that this level of information, these little pictures about decay rates and decay topologies, this is more than enough to start doing theoretical physics. And this is why we should target this level of information early on in LHC analysis. So let me just give a couple of very concrete examples, one of which will be very simple and the other not so. So suppose the net result of a spectroscopic analysis is that we discover that a picture like this seems to describe data at the LHC very well, that there's evidence for some kind of quark partner at a high mass scale, an intermediate mass gluon partner, and by partner I just mean a particle that's high mass that has gauge and global quantum numbers like a gluon or like a quark, that's all I mean. And then we have something unknown here at the bottom. And let's say we know more. We know that this top quark partner, it decays into something, into a quark, okay? And then it decays into this gluon partner. And let's say we also know the gluon partner decays into light quarks plus this unknown thing. This is a very simple set of topologies. And we even know something about the production cross section. So this is actually this would be a good sign. It looks like there might actually be dynamics that can explain the origin of the weak scale. Immediately from this information, a number of interesting conclusions can be drawn. So for starters, just quantitatively knowing how often you see light quarks instead of what are known as B and top quarks, the heaviest quarks in the standard model, you can immediately draw a conclusion about the mass scale of any new physics that comes in that pairs up with the top and the bottom quark. Okay. Now, how do you know this? You know this because if there were a partner of the top or the bottom quark in this picture, well, how would it show up? You don't see it down here. You have some evidence for it. In fact, you know spectroscopically that you're producing quark partners here, but they're not bottom and top partners, because otherwise this would be a bottom or a top quark. So they'd have to be heavier. And the way you would probe that mass scale is by looking at the rate of the decay of this object here. This is a gluon partner. And in any underlying description, you would expect the decay to occur through some virtual process that involves the quark partner. But the rate for that scales like the fourth power of the mass of that partner. So by not seeing bottom and top quarks here, but instead seeing only light quarks, you know that the mass scale of the bottom and top partners is very, very high. Okay? Why do we care? Well, we care because immediately with this information, we're left wondering what is responsible for removing the worst part of the UV sensitivity of the weak scale. So I alluded to the Higgs boson earlier. So what makes the weak scale susceptible to these quantum corrections that want to push it off to the Planck scale are quantum corrections from both the top quark and other states. The top quark dominates these quantum corrections, and this wants to push the weak scale off to a very high mass scale. So all theories of beyond the standard model physics that address this problem introduce top partners, something that can come in here and cancel off the quantum corrections. So the mass scale associated with this dynamics is extremely important for addressing whether or not there's some natural solution to this problem. Okay. So we expect particles with quantum numbers to do this, and so just spectroscopic information is enough to tell if there's an issue or not. And immediately now, this could entirely change the way we think about physics. If we don't find some explanation in the form of particles that appear to dynamically soften the UV sensitivity of the weak scale, then immediately we'll start wondering how in the world can the weak scale be so light compared to gravity, and we'll start. Go ahead.
Won't these cancellations produce another fine-tuning problem? Because you have new particles trying to cancel the old problem. This can produce fine-tuning.
Yeah, there could still be dynamics to weak scale, and it could still look fine-tuned. But that's a little bit in the eye of the beholder. This example is clean because there would be no evidence for top partner within reach. This fine-tuning would be pretty severe. But we can talk more about this. Now, another example, is very similar to the one I just showed. Now, we could still see a mass spectrum that looks like this. But now I'm going to go ahead and assume that we see bottom and top quarks here. Okay. So that looks good for the hierarchy problem, but what would you be able to learn from these pictures? Well, we have this symbol that I've denoted here is missing energy. So this is what you see in a detector when you can't see the energy of all the outgoing states. So this is evidence for some stable particle that's carrying away some fraction of the energy. Okay. Now, that is indicative of the production of dark matter. So that immediately the question would be, if you have some stable particle that you're producing at the LHC, can it be dark matter? So we have these pictures. What can we learn? Well, good candidates for dark matter are heavy particles that are neutral under quantum numbers, under electromagnetism. Good candidates for these, though, are particles that have the same gauge and global quantum numbers as the photon, the W, or the Z, perhaps neutrinos, perhaps Higgs. So partners of those states in the standard model. Those are good dark matter candidates. Okay? Now, you can use the decay rate information that you get by trying to fit to data with simple pictures like this to try to sort out these possibilities. So let me just go through this logic a little bit quickly to not belabor this point. But for example, if you see a bottom and a top decay mode here, a bottom and a top paired together, you would immediately conclude that it's not sufficient to have a state that's neutral down here, that's just neutral. You would have evidence for some sort of charge flow, because you can't conserve charge otherwise. Okay. So options like having just a photon partner that are light would immediately be ruled out, or would certainly be disfavored. But you can look, there's only a handful of other possibilities in that case. So you could still have partners of the W, for example. That would give you a charge channel. But if that happens, then you would look at the other part of the spectrum. If you have a partner of the W, you would expect something that has the quantum numbers of a quark to also decay into it, which is something you can look for. Okay, so if you know the data is well described by this, and there's some constraint on this alternative decay, then you can rule this option out. Likewise, you can imagine it's a Higgs partner, and that gives you a charged channel, but that has an associated signature that you can look for. All right? And in fact, what you learn from this simple spectroscopy is that the only option that works for these for this set of decay topologies is to have a Higgs partner down here and not much else. But actually, on very general grounds, already from this you can tell that this is not consistent with thermal dark matter. And moreover, it's also inconsistent with direct detection. Now, what does that mean? Is that a big deal? Well, it could mean that this Higgs partner is unstable. That would be a pretty important clue about the theory at the weak scale here. So all we're doing is we're using essentially rate and decay topology arguments to piece together a consistent picture for what could explain dark matter or the origin of naturalness. This is certainly how model building starts. Okay? So spectroscopy is providing the building blocks, and so I want to focus on sharpening the extraction of spectroscopy from early LHC data, should new physics evidence arise. Okay, now in some cases this is really straightforward, all right? In some cases you can just see all of the final states of new physics, so we could go back to the discovery of the W and the Z. Well, the Z boson shows up in resonances, so the Z boson you can produce and it can decay to an electron and a positron. You can see them. You can take the four vectors and reconstruct the mass. And in fact, I mean, so I'm just illustrating that here in a plot from CDF data. Okay, so in that case, you can get at the masses directly, and by looking at the final states and the decays, you can extract the strengths of couplings and also spins in a rather straightforward way. So that's the easy case. And I would say there's certainly prejudice to think that the Higgs sector is like that now, that finding the Higgs may be very difficult, but characterizing it may be simpler because direct mass reconstruction is possible. Okay? So almost everything I'm about to say now is not going to apply to the Higgs sector. Because in fact, most models of new physics, and certainly there's a lot of indirect arguments to suspect this, require significantly more complicated structure. And that's because to resolve the hierarchy problem or to provide a good candidate for dark matter, you need to have particles that carry gauge and global quantum numbers that pair up with standard model particles. And there's usually discrete symmetries around that give rise to a stable particle. That means that a typical production process at the LHC will be initiated by particles that are produced that are strongly interacting. Well, they have to decay. So they'll decay to some number of quarks or gluons potentially. So this will give rise to what we call jets. And then then they'll continue to be a cascade to any number of different possibilities into things like Ws and Zs and leptons. This is the part of the decay chain that doesn't carry any charge into the strong interactions. But then if there's a particle that's stable, then at the very end you get sort of stuck because now you have an object that carries away some fraction of the energy. And this makes direct mass reconstruction in a sort of simple way completely impossible.
Pair up. That's an assumption, right? It can just be a strong interaction. The particles are pairing as well.
Absolutely. This is just a motivation for thinking that we may that mass reconstruction could be difficult. Because the easy case is one where everything is visible. We think we know how to deal with that. And then it'll reduce then I think constructing these pictures, the spectroscopy, will be still difficult but a little more straightforward. Not something that requires the framework I'm about to talk about.
How do you decide experimentally when the particle is stable?
Let's call it stable on the time scale of the detector. So stable not in the literal sense. Okay? Long lived. Let's call it long lived. You don't know that it's stable. But for this purpose, it doesn't matter. If it leaves the detector and you can't see it, you still can't do full mass.
It matters for dark matter. It matters for dark matter.
It matters for dark matter.
It has to be stable.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you decide it?
That's a separate issue that we'll come to later. So there'd be separate experiments we'd have to carry out to decide that question. Okay. The LHC by itself will not decide it. Okay. Now it's natural to try and build a spectroscopic picture, even in these difficult cases, by taking a full model or a Lagrangian and fitting it to data. The problem with this is that Lagrangians contain much more information than is directly observable. Okay?
So this, at a practical level, this is certainly a nuisance. So it immediately leads you to ask the question, is it possible to find a description of new physics that's actually simpler than a full-blown Lagrangian or field theory directly, okay? Something that's closely related but is much simpler. And the reason you want to do this is you want to find a simple way to actually give meaning to these pictures so that you can describe them in a so that you can simulate them in a Hadron Collider environment. Okay? So we want to find a simple description. Now, there's another reason to want to find a simple description. The current state of affairs in particle theory is that we have a phenomenally large number of models of new physics at the weak scale that address different problems that have popped up over the last 20 years. There's a huge number of options to check. In practice, searches and resolution at the LHC is such that many of these possibilities will look the same, certainly in a first pass. So there's just a question about how you go about searching for new physics to try to find any of these options. And if you do find some evidence, how do you try to describe it so that you can figure out which of the many options it is? Now, at a practical level, then, there's a desire to try to find a description that allows you to collapse this huge space of possibilities into a much smaller space and give you sort of a fewer number of options to work with that have a good chance of describing the data so that you can then try to solve the inverse problem of figuring out what the theory is. Okay, so that's the motivation for wanting a description of new physics that's simple and what some of the problems are. So now I need to give you a little bit just of collider physics review so that I can talk about something called shape invariance at hadron colliders. So this is a set of symmetries that exist in 2-to-2 processes at hadron colliders. This is a technical point I'll make, but there's a large set of symmetries in hard scattering reactions at hadron colliders that you can exploit to create a simplified description for new physics. Okay. All right, so I think this should be familiar to at least many of you, but when protons collide, usually what happens is there's a mess of reactions that end up generating activity in the directions of the proton beams, and every once in a while, there'll be a process where one of the constituents of each proton meets and collides in a so-called hard scattering reaction. And then you can produce something very heavy that way. All right? So you'll have constituents that can carry some fraction of the energy of each proton and give rise to a hard scattering process. So this is what we care about. Okay? We don't care about all of this stuff. What we care about is this hard scattering process here. Okay? Now, let me just give you a couple of, just tell you in quantitative terms how you would describe this reaction. So it's a 2-to-2 reaction. So in characterizing the final states, useful variables to use are what's known in the subject as rapidity. So this is a variable that is essentially telling you about the direction in the detector that a particle is going. And it's useful because it has nice properties under boosts along the beam. So if you have two particles that differ by a particular value of rapidity, then as you boost either in and out of the beam direction, that rapidity difference will be the same. And this turns out to be useful. Okay. And then also what is directly extracted is the transverse momentum of particles that you produce. So with these two variables, you can reconstruct full four vectors if you know the identity of the particle that you've made. So if you know that it's an electron, then you know that it's approximately massless. And so you have a mass, rapidity, and a PT. That's enough information to reconstruct the four vector. Okay. Now, beyond just describing the 2-to-2 process using transverse momentum and rapidity variables, in the actual final state itself, you want to pair up different particles to look for resonances or to look for other kinematic features. So the most common is just pairing up different states. So in the case of a resonance, you would see a bump like this. But for the type of decay topology that I just showed you, what you would see would be quite a bit more ambiguous. So you could have a particle that decays to a lepton, and then something either virtual or on shell, some other new particle, which then decays to a lepton, and then we could just keep on going. If you pair these objects up and you look at their invariant mass, instead of forming a resonance, which would be characteristic of this mass scale, what you do is you fill out some distribution like this. It's a blob, okay? Now, fortunately, the blob, the endpoint of the blob does tell you something. The endpoint of the blob does tell you about some combination of mass differences in this decay chain. So there's some information there. And actually, going one step beyond that, if this intermediate object here, depending on whether or not it's gone on shell, meaning you've produced it as a particle that's living close to its mass shell, or if it's virtual, that actually shows up in these distributions. So if it's virtual, it will tend to look like a blob, and if you have something that's close to its mass shell, the distribution can get cut off and you can see a sharp feature. In practice, features never look this sharp. It always gets smeared out by mass resolution and detector effects. Okay. Now, there's many more variables like this, but one point I want to make is that in practice, it's difficult to use these variables unless you know ahead of time what the decay topology is. There's a problem of just pairing up the right states and then associating meanings in the form of diagrams to what you've just constructed. Okay? So you want to know topology. So it's useful to think about simpler variables that don't require knowing much about the topology ahead of time. So for that, there's the transverse momentum of events. And this is something that is extremely important to get right in describing new physics. So for example, if you have a bunch of particles that you see in an event, and you sum up all the transverse momentum, and then what's left over is just missing energy, then new physics will have this characteristic property that it'll peak at some location, and then, of course, it has a tail. Now, in reality, this is buried in a background, but if you could separate it, the location of the peak and its shape tells you something about the mass scale and the mass differences of particles that you're producing. Okay, so this is giving you some access into the mass scale. You can then break apart what's going on even further, and you can look at individual transverse momentum of particular objects. So if you're producing some state, which I'm denoting by this line, and it decays to a jet, which then decays to a lepton, so that you have, say, a lepton and a jet to work with, you can look at their transverse momentum, and the magnitude and shape of those distributions tells you something about the spacing of those particles in the decay spectrum. So this gives you further information to estimate the mass scale in any given decay topology. So the point here is that if you're going to describe new physics well in a first pass, this information, it's simple, it gives you information about masses, you want to get it right. You want to get transverse momentum structure correct if you're going to model new physics. Okay? All right, so I'm just reiterating what I said. Transverse momentum is key. Okay? So what I want to now do is quantitatively go through and understand what aspects of that hard scattering process that I just told you about, what bits of information actually go into determining that transverse momentum, the kinematics, and I'll also in the process tell you what goes into determining the cross-section. Okay? We want to understand that because in practice, most of this information is largely just determined by particle masses, and you'll see that we can throw out most of the information that we normally put there. Okay? So quantitatively, if you want to compute a scattering probability, it's just given by some probability here for the hard reaction to occur. So I'm imagining here that we have, for example, a quark and a gluon inside the proton, and they scatter. Okay? So if it were just a beam of quark and gluons, you could compute the scattering probability for that process to occur. And that's this factor over here. You have to multiply that by the probability that there are quarks and gluons that carry the right kinematics for this reaction to occur. That's what these are known as parton distribution functions. So you have to fold those in. And then you integrate over phase space. And that gives you the scattering probability for the final state as you see it. Now, what's important to understand first are these objects here that people refer to as parton. When they're integrated over part of the phase space, they're referred to as parton luminosities. And essentially, it's just telling you how the proton-proton collision can be broken down into collisions that involve just quarks or gluons and gluons, or other different constituents. So this factor that I just showed you, this factor integrated over the center of mass boost, this is the parton luminosity. It's sort of telling you how much initial state you're starting with. They all have the property that they fall very quickly with center of mass energy, okay? So in order to scatter into a process that involves some amount of center of mass energy, I'm going to call it, it's S hat. S hat is the center of mass energy that you need, and I'm normalizing it with respect to the total center of mass energy of the proton-proton system. You need to exceed a certain amount for a reaction to occur, okay? And then once you get above that threshold, you can produce anything above that threshold. So you have to integrate over everything above threshold of the parton luminosity times that 2 to 2 process. But these all fall. So in practice, new states, when they're heavy, are produced rather slowly. They're not very slow. They're semi-relativistic, okay? Because in practice, you're dominated right near threshold. Production is dominated right near threshold. Okay, so this will turn out to be an important fact. Okay. Additionally, production is always dominated for a given coupling strength by the lightest particle. And that's because these PDFs are falling really quickly. So for a given mass scale, it's not just one over the mass scale that sets the sort of the probability for scattering. It's a high power of that mass scale, because you have to convolve it with these very fastly falling parton luminosities. Okay? So the point is that lightest particles always dominate production for any given quantum number. And that simplifies new physics generally as well. Because you may have many, many, many different states, but let's say you look at the many different strongly coupled states, it'll always be the lightest one that you're producing. And it's for this reason. Okay. Now, I think to save time, I'm going to go ahead and skip to the point. So what we can do is do the most general thing possible and expand 2-to-2 reactions in a very general way. And you can write down a matrix element or a scattering probability for the 2-to-2 process as just some expansion in an angular variable and a center of mass variable. Okay. And you find a sort of remarkable thing. So let me just walk you through this picture. So on the x-axis here is the transverse momentum. Okay, it's normalized to be dimensionless. And then I'm just showing the shape of what you would see transverse momentum-wise as you change the matrix element. So this is the center of mass energy dependence, and this is some angular variable. And this can be done in a very general way. But I'm illustrating, so for different choices of angular dependence, you get threshold suppressed. And that's because these angular variables have velocity dependence in them. And because you're produced semi-relativistically, the expectation value of that velocity factor is small. So higher and higher powers of these angular variables get suppressed. Now, that's nice. But much more important than that is that that entire infinite family of matrix elements looks the same. Okay. So maybe you didn't see this. All of these objects here, and there's a whole tower of them, if you normalize their shapes with respect to one another, they have the same shape. There's small corrections to this fact, but this whole family of matrix elements looks the same in the transverse structure. Now, there's a very simple reason for this. Maybe the calculation is not the most interesting thing to walk through, but if we go ahead and actually just analytically calculate, and I'll just leave this as an exercise, so you can just trust me. All of these shapes that you're seeing in the transverse structure are dictated by a single universal function, okay, that controls how all of these transverse momentum distributions look, with sort of one free parameter, which depends on how steeply falling the parton distribution function is, okay, depends on that. But that's just given. That's just standard model physics. So that's not really a free parameter. And then it depends on what the energy dependence near threshold is, okay? So that's actually the only thing that determines how that transverse shape looks. And then the magnitude is just given by Euler beta functions, things that don't have any kinematic dependence in them in this case. Okay? Now, there's a completely analogous statement for rapidity distributions. These are the angular variables that you tell how forward or central a particle is in your detector. You can look at different variations of the center of mass energy dependence of the 2-to-2 process. And higher powers of this energy dependence, X is the center of mass energy over S. So X is literally that factor. Higher powers of X get suppressed. But again, they all look the same. They all have the same shape. Okay. So the point here is that entire families of theories that give rise to different matrix elements for the 2-to-2 process, they'll all look like one another when you look at particular PT, these transverse momentum and rapidity variables. Okay, so a lot of this structure just gets removed by the fact that these parton luminosities are rapidly falling functions, and they're essentially polynomial-like near threshold. Just very, very simple physics that explains why this is true. Now, the reason this is useful information is that it tells you exactly how to strip out information. It tells you what information you're not going to see in a first pass. It also tells you what you should pay attention to before trying to make, essentially it tells you what kind of ambiguities to expect. Okay. But we want to turn this to our advantage. We want to use the fact that this information gets removed, that the shape information is not there for you to exploit, figure out what the under what the underlying matrix element is. Yeah, they're just that's just a number, and it has no kinematic dependence in it exactly, and the shape is universal. Okay. So you can use this to define a simplified way of describing new physics. This is that's simpler than a field theory. And if you do this, this will suggest a number of ways of searching for and characterizing new physics. But let me just tell you what the idea is. So by example, you can take this is top quark, anti-top quark production from gluons. So there's some detailed reaction that you can compute here. And ordinarily, where there's specific Feynman rules you associate and particular couplings that you associate to these vertices, what you would do is you keep all the particles on shell, and you collapse all the vertices to these blobs, and you give them particular well-defined rules. Okay. And so at this level, the reaction quantitatively can be described by an overall rate. Okay, and that's just the constant factors. You can add up all those constant terms, and you just stick them into what you want to call the cross section. And then there's some, go ahead.
So the arguments you just finished, they were based on the PDF structure and the Parkov model and the usual factorization formula.
Right.
So when you start to restrict the final states of cutting out the beam and such, people doing QCD are now talking about beam functions, which is reduced to the Parkov model, but they introduce further scales in the problem. Mm-hmm. Does any of your arguments depend upon that? So being just the Parkov model, like, do you know if that sort of complication is just
this argument is so crude. The only thing that we required is that whatever you want to call the parton distribution functions convolved with these cuts, as long as it's smooth near threshold, smoothness, that's all you need. And then this fact will be true. So not much is required.
Your Unless formula was very simple, but if there are other scales, I could see it becoming more complicated.
Yeah, so the way it would become more complicated is if there's a new scale that's right near thresholds. In other words, if you're placing a cut right near the threshold of the particle production, then there could be a problem. So to the extent that that's the case, but see, here's what's nice. You know ahead of time where this approximation is going to fail. It's a well-understood approximation. Okay, so we're not just throwing information out willy-nilly. We have some controlled way of throwing it out. All right. So now these diagrams that I was showing you earlier, where I didn't tell you about the underlying field theory that you needed to actually simulate the events precisely, we can literally replace them by cross sections and then branching ratios to tell you how often these decays occur and mass scales. So a little bit more quantitatively, the actual parametrization of these reactions that captures the vast majority of new physics processes looks like this. It's a constant plus the first order threshold correction. Okay, and it's not obvious if I were just to show this to you that this would actually work in the vast majority of cases, but it does. Now, decay can be done just by demanding that you decay according to some phase space. You don't have to worry about the matrix element structure in the decay, but to the extent needed, you can include angular correlations if you want. Now, the reason it's important to actually rather precisely understand how to strip this information out and provide a definition for all these scattering reactions is that for any of these observations to be useful, you have to have some quantitative rules for simulating events in a Monte Carlo tool for experiments to use and for experiments to use in searches and characterizing data so that they can, so that you can actually encapsulate information in a reasonable way. So this gives a precise way of actually simulating what new physics looks like, but without having to supply arbitrary amounts of top-down information. You can just supply mass scales, and you can just supply topology information, and off you go. You have a system, you have systematic understanding of what information you're sensitive to, namely in the form of just this parameterization. In fact, you can drop the near threshold corrections if you think they're going to be small, which in most cases they are. I mean, these are like few percent effects. And you can even just go with the constant term. So you're really not providing much. Okay. Now, this immediately spells out, there's a number of applications that that come to mind immediately as soon as you realize that you can actually get away with this. So the first is that this approximation scheme actually gives teeth to the notion of model independence. Okay, model independence, so sometimes, I don't know if this is a familiar term to this audience, but something that has been occurring in particle physics over the last several years is as the number of models has exploded,
there's been a desire to see searches done in a way that are sensitive to the largest number of models possible. Now, in practice, searches are often optimized in particular kinds of models, particular kinds of benchmarks, right? And these benchmarks have a few representative topologies in them. And you sort of cross your fingers and hope for the best. You hope that you have, we hope that experiments have searches that are sensitive to a lot, even though they're optimizing on a few kinds of topologies. So if you can throw out all of the model dependence, and here we're literally tossing out Lagrangians, okay? We're tossing out, you know, top-down models, and we're just going with kinematics, just spectroscopy. Then you can very quantitatively assess whether or not a given search is sensitive to all these different kinds of topologies. Just, this is a very practical issue. Just quantitatively, you can assess it by using these OSETs. So that gives you some starting point for actually creating model-independent searches and actually determining if they really are model-independent, because you can forget about the details and just ask, are we sensitive to different kinds of kinematics? Okay, so actually, how does this work in practice? So this is something that CMS has been pursuing as a build-up to searching for new physics at the LHC. So I think this is largely the Santa Barbara and the Vienna group in CMS. So so what you want to do is you want to try to optimize sensitivity for, we'll call them general models, or really we'll call them simplified models later. And then you want to present results in parameterized directly in terms of just mass scales and cross sections and not worry about detailed underlying parameters of whatever the underlying theory is. Just want to work with the spectroscopic information. Okay, so as I've already said, particular models are particularly weak on this point, like M-Suger-based descriptions. So what you would do, so this is the first thing that that actually the Santa Barbara group looked at, is they looked at the benchmarks that are currently used. So there are these benchmarks called LM points. These are different types of top-down models where you define SUSY at some high scale and actually you run it down, and then you see what the spectrum is. And there's various ways of doing this, okay? And they all give rise to some spectrum of different strongly and weakly interacting states with different decay chains. Now, in any given search, what you end up doing is you end up being sensitive to a sort of representative classes of topologies in these searches. So the first question they ask is, can you take an OSET or some simplified description and accurately model these benchmarks? And the answer is the answer is yes, and it's sort of shocking in any given search how simple the descriptions are. So in particular, in a class of hadronic searches, and there's analogs for leptonic searches, you can model all the physics that you thought the benchmark was encapsulating with a really simple OSET approximation. You can just assume you have some particle with, and there's a couple of variants of quantum numbers you can assume up here, and it decays into a jet, and then it cascades into another jet. And this can give rise to different topologies you can simulate. It accurately describes the benchmark, so you're not losing anything, okay? So here on the right are some plots, actually, showing different PT variables for different jets, showing different, what I called HT earlier, showing missing energy. These are different kinematic distributions that you use in a search, and you can accurately reproduce the benchmark. So then you say, okay, great, so I haven't lost anything by not using the benchmark, but now it's really easy to go ahead and perturb this description to make sure that I'm sensitive to topologies that are closely related, okay? So in particular, you can create, and this is how you, so you can start, for example, with three jet topologies, which might have been the focus point of your search, but then you can make sure just by tacking on additional structure, you can add additional jets at the end of the decay chain, you can add additional jets in different combinations to the left or the right part of the decay chain in these cases. And what you do is you create families of search topologies, which you then use to make sure that whatever search you're doing is netting as much as possible, okay? And you can do this in a fairly simple way because you don't have to worry about the underlying model details. So this is good for all of us because it improves the odds that you actually uncover new physics if it's there, just because you're sort of broadening the extent to what you're looking to. You're broadening the extent to which you're looking for different kinds of physics. Okay. Now, very quickly, though, if you do see something, there's also another application, which is that you can try to go straight for spectroscopy and using these OSETs. All right. So what do you do in this case? I can only give you a schematic overview because this is really a talk in and of itself. Okay. The whole idea here is instead of taking full-blown models, you create a set of sort of smaller, sort of simplified models that involve far fewer moving parts. And you sort of zero in your attention on particular aspects of the spectrum that you want to understand piece by piece. So in this example, so in this particular case, one simplified model class is something where the new physics is dominantly being produced through a partner of the quark, of quarks, okay? So they all have this sort of production is occurring through a quark partner. And what you want to zero in on is you want to assess to what extent that hypothesis is consistent, and then in the process assess what the electroweak decay chains are, whether or not you're just directly producing something stable, or whether or not in the process there's W's and Z's, or there's additional leptons. Okay? So you don't need any more than an OSET to ask this question. But I can convince you with more time that a set of 4 or 5 of these little models spans a huge parameter space, both within SUSY, within extra dimensions. In this particular case, you can span SUSY-like physics with these simplified models. And the goal here, then, is you do a simple fit to data with simple signatures. And the goal here is just to try to is to build evidence for the particles that you can actually see. You want to know concretely, are you actually seeing particles that are partners of the quark? Are you seeing particles that are partners of the gluon? Are there actually cascade decays happening? You want to identify these pieces one by one. Okay? So in simple fits, you typically get a fairly good description of data. And this is true in a broad class of theories. But what you really care about then are the deviations. And these simplified models can be designed so that the deviations are suggestive. So the one that the simplified model I showed you earlier is designed to keep these cascades really simple, the reason being that starting from simple cascades, you can actually build evidence for additional structure in these decays. So for example, on all of these plots, so I'm showing different lepton PT distributions. And you'll see that, for example, shown here is the pseudodata in this example. And then there's different fits using these simplified models. And it agrees relatively, I mean, broadly speaking, it agrees. But then you have these problems. At low PT, if you look at the invariant masses of different pairs, there's some issues. And of course, the giveaway is actually that if you look at the invariant mass of electrons and muons, or things that have different flavor, there's this big discrepancy at low invariant mass relative to these simplified models. Okay, but what this is doing is it's singling your attention on the origin of this structure that has to show up in the decay chains here. You started with something simple. So this discrepancy, for example, immediately tells you that there's some additional state in here. Okay. You get a pretty good description of the data with something very simple, a one-stage cascade. But these deviations tell you that there's probably something else going on. Now of course, this process continues. You can start with that observation, and you can notice that there's actually two ways of doing it. You can insert a new state that reproduces these deviations, either by putting it near some intermediate state that you already included, or by moving it towards the bottom of the decay chain. So these are qualitatively different options that are important to determine for in order to actually construct the model. But you can go even further and start thinking about underlying theories that may reproduce this particular hierarchy of spectra. And so, for example, you could think about SUSY and start listing a large number of options that would give rise to very similar electroweak decays, but would in turn be separable by differences they have in the strongly interacting part. So I'm going through this very quickly and schematically, because what I'm trying to illustrate is that by starting from something simple, in this case, just one particle being produced, and then different variations for the cascade decays, you can actively try to build evidence for additional states with particular quantum numbers that may be appearing in here. Okay. Well, except that this is not technically being described by a Lagrangian. You could go ahead and take, for example, you could take the MSSM, and you could choose a particular parameterization in the MSSM to mock this up. But it's a messy looking parameterization.
Just take the particle X and I couple with just not worrying about Gaussian variance, just putting in Lorentzian variance.
Because you can do that too, but many of those different options will also collapse under these shape invariances to the same kind of thing.
Won't your numbers just become the coefficients of that Lagrangian? Or you have something for
yeah, but it's in particular, if you do a fit then to these different reactions, the cross section will have the meaning in your language of being a particular linear combination of operators. Okay. So in other words, there'll be a non-unique way of writing down an effective theory that maps one of these simplified models, because this contains less information than that.
What would be an example of something that I would be that would be combined between Lagrangian and something like this?
Sorry, say again?
Can you give me an example of something where it's not that you're saying that there's too much information in Lagrangian compared to these amplitudes that you're talking about? So what would be an example of something?
For example, spin. Okay. So the actual spin of these states. You could write down various possibilities with different spins. But at this level of analysis, it would be very unlikely that you'd be able to tell the difference, because the difference in spin of this particle up here to first order would affect the angular correlation at production, but actually that does not affect the transverse structure. So you can look for that effect, but as far as estimating mass scales and decay rates, you can actually get away with completely ignoring that issue at a first pass. You don't have to, but you have the option of doing it, and it's actually useful. So all of the different spin options could be collapsed into a single category. And then what you can do is you can go back and figure out what does the decay pattern look like, and then say, well, but now I really want to know the spin. And then you can go ahead and put that information back in. Okay. But you see in a first pass, it's sort of useful to maybe collapse it in one direction to get the decay information and then back it up and include a little bit more information.
Another way of saying that would be to say that since you know that you're not going to have enough information to get the spin, it doesn't make a difference what spin you choose. So choose something simple and then...
Well, except, yeah, I mean, there's this, that's one way of saying it, except I think, you know, a lot of progress has actually been made in trying to understand how to extract spin in LHC data, mm-hmm. So it'd be too quick to just write off spin altogether, but there is sort of a systematic way of first removing it and then including it back in. You want to understand precisely in what ways it shows up.
So each blob, it's not, when I unpack a blob, it's not like I'm adding in terms of Lagrangian, it's just another way, you just have particular rules to write an amplitude.
Right, that's all.
So before you talked about 2-2, but like a decay would be a different...
The decays are phase space and the simple approximation. Yeah. And it's again because of these shaping variances. The decay matrix elements get washed out precisely as well. Now in practice, as soon as you actually have a pretty clear picture for what the spectroscopy looks like, you would then go back to including to writing down several options for Lagrangian theories. So I was, in this example, I'm not showing you all the distributions that justify this point, but in this example, the spectroscopy, which is this picture, is that this spectroscopy does a good job of describing the data, but if you wanted to investigate it within the context of supersymmetry, you would immediately, just from this particular texture, be drawn to these three options. You have to combine this with some additional information. But then you would say, okay, well, let's go ahead and take the full-blown Lagrangian description of supersymmetry, the MSSM, but in these particular corners of parameter space, and study it very precisely and see if it actually works. Okay. So all you're really doing is using the simplified description as sort of as an intermediate point to get a decent description of the data, to give you a clue about what the underlying theory is supposed to look like, so that you can set up for more precise investigation. That's really what this is about.
Okay, so I think in the first part, I hope I convinced you that it's spectroscopy that we're after as theorists. And certainly the LHC can provide that. It will be challenging. In the process of wanting to get spectroscopy, it's desirable to strip out information that you can't measure in a first pass. So there is a systematic way of doing this so that you can have a description of new physics that's fairly simple and connects to spectroscopy readily. So that's what these OSETs are for. Okay, and I think just schematically through this example, hopefully I've illustrated the flavor of this process. And on that note, I'll just note that this year, the exploration of the TEV scale will commence. Now, it will take quite a while, I think, before there are either discoveries of the Higgs or discoveries of new physics. There's a number of reasons for that. But once there is a discovery of any kind, if it looks, unless it's fairly simple, this process of trying to understand the spectroscopy, these pictures with different mass scales and different decay topologies, this will take some time. This was a hard problem. I think this will take a lot of close collaboration between theory and experiment. But it's out of that process that I think the next set of theoretical puzzles that we'll be worried about for years to come will emerge. So thank you.
Are there questions for Bill?
Wait.
So a lot of your thinking is based on Susie on weakly coupled theories. Can you make a definitive statement about how this applies to strongly coupled theories without partners, canceling hierarchy problems? And to what degree you think this will also apply? Do you think it applies exactly? Or is there limitations in this picture that would show up when you get away from weakly coupled with lots of partners?
Okay.
Missing energy.
So if there's missing energy, so that direct mass reconstruction is not so doable, and but the theory is still strongly coupled, then not much of what I said changes. In practice, that's just the widths could be broad, but that can be accommodated easily. Okay, so just at that technical level, that could be dealt with. If there's not missing energy, if direct reconstruction is possible, then I think that was a case I talked about. I think you can do reconstruction directly. So one thing you might worry about, maybe this is what you're asking, or what about gauge and global quantum numbers that are not within SUSY, for example? That's also fine. I limited my discussion to SUSY-like physics principally because it's familiar. Principally because there's a wide class of theories that sort of look like supersymmetry. But additional gauge and global quantum numbers are totally straightforward to include in this description. My justification of the shape invariance is unmodified. That just affects the decay topology that you decide to include.
Not depend on any of those details. No. That's purely coming out of parton models.
That's purely just parton model intuition and smoothness in your threshold. That's
I guess the thing you need to worry most about is when it breaks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's actually why I included that you include these first order corrections. You can assess just what kind of uncertainty you're introducing by using this approximation. You always want to know what your error bar is, and that's what those terms are for.
Regarding the nature of synergy breaking, which by the way is now 46 years old, one thing you would want to do is measure WW to WW longitudinal flux, and you see the ghost on bosons. However, in reality, it's a chain of mess. If you put gluons, it's a fusion process,
right?
You see. So you end up with some nasty Monte Carlo calculation measure. So how did you put this thesis?
I think, so what you look for in that case are whatever final states this reaction. So I mean, it depends on what you want to assume about the dynamics. If it's going strong, then it's just a dileptons study. So I think it's as simple as that. As simple as.
Can you use these simplifying arguments to simplify the problem? Otherwise, it just becomes a Monte Carlo statistical problem.
You could, but in that particular instance, see, I mean, this, I don't want to try to say that this is something you'd want to do to every single problem under the sun at the LHC. There's a particular class of problems that we're interested in. In that particular case, we sort of have an idea of what the final states are ahead of time. And so we might, so given that, and given that in that case, you're taking pairs of leptons, so you can do full mass reconstruction in this case. You don't think you're missing any energy. So you might as well include a little bit of more information than I'm including here in the first pass, just because you're already on better experimental footing, so to speak. Okay, so I would not, for example, advocate this for that question.
Still need the cross section, probably.
You would, yeah. I mean, there's still a cross section input, but I would actually include more angular correlations in that particular analysis in the first pass, because you probably are sensitive to it in that case, because there's no missing energy. You have seeing the complete final state.
Any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Philip again.